Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nekias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing well, doing great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for embracing your bounce. I'm in a good place right now, Nekias, a good space. Life is a journey. You have to take the moments that you can. Focus on your blessings. I am unbothered like Ben Simmons.
As we look at the current score of that game, it is Nets a lot, Sixers a little bit. I definitely understand why Ben Simmons is unbothered. Joining us is a guest. We have Sabrina Merchant in the house of SB Nation. Sabrina, how are you doing tonight?
I am delighted to be here. I had a Ben Simmons joke prepared as well, but unfortunately, I think that's the ship has sailed. So.
Nope. Shoot your shots. We just let them fly. Trust me. Yeah.
Some other time.
All right. We'll have to bring you back just for the joke. But we are going to chop it up. No longer covering the Los Angeles Clippers, but you have been a Clippers voice for quite some time. So you wanted to break down a team in the West that I don't think Steve and I have gotten super deep on the Clippers yet. It feels like it's always been in passing. Like, hey, here's another injury. Hey, they're playing well right now. Well, now they're kind of slipping, and it's just kind of it. So we want to dig into them. Before we get into some Clippers talk, I did want to ask you two a question about Russell Westbrook, since he is back in the news again. There's been commentary about fan behavior once again, which is an exhausting conversation to have. Recent comments from him were talking about how his family didn't feel comfortable coming to games at this point. The criticism that he receives in the crowd has gotten to the point where his family's uncomfortable. He's kind of shrugged it off, and now he's at the point where he's like, okay, I need to confront this now. Sabrina, I'll start with you. What were your thoughts on what he said, and how do you feel about, I guess, the relationship between fan and player at this point?
On the one hand, I'm very sad because the idea of Russ coming home to LA was supposed to be really fun, even if it was never going to be as successful on the court as some might have hoped. I just thought the idea of him, local product UCLA guy, finally getting to play for the Lakers should have been fun. And it has never been fun. Not for one moment this season has the Laker fan Russell Westbrook experience been fun. And that's just a bummer for a guy who has probably dreamt about this for 30 some years. So I hate that for him. I hate that for his family. Just the fact that his family doesn't feel comfortable coming to see him at games, or he doesn't feel comfortable having them in the crowds. Like, just terrible all around. And I guess when there's nothing of significance to talk about basketball-wise, this is a good time to approach it. But I just had a question about why he thought the Westbrook name was disrespectful. Like, to me, that's just like the clearest criticism of his play. Like, it's not personal at all to me. You know, it's just, hey, his name's Westbrook and he bricks a lot. Like, I didn't understand that part, but hey. If he's uncomfortable with it, that's fine. Like, Laker fans stopped calling Austin Reeves Hillbilly Kobe when he said he was uncomfortable with it. So, you know, you got to take the man at his word.
Got you. Steve, where are you on this?
I think it's unfortunate. When you talk about, you know, family, it hits a different note. When your family's affected, it hits different. When, you know, your child is so proud of you and now they don't feel the same pride, or you don't feel like that's a comfortable environment for them to express that pride, or you're trying to shield them from feeling shame based on just basketball play. Like, it probably hits a little different in that area. So that part just stinks. And it's just, it feels like just such a perfect storm or imperfect storm as far as Russ goes, because there've been people have been waiting for this moment. And he's not playing to his standard, and the Lakers aren't playing well. So it's a combination of all that. And it just feels like everything he does gets magnified now. And it's kind of crazy to me. It's crazy to me. Because, like, it just doesn't feel like Russ can be Russ in this scenario, and people are expecting him to be Russ. I go on that one.
What we have, we'll have to say that for another show. Another show. Like, I echo both of your sentiments. Like, it is just kind of unfortunate. Like, this has been just a failed experiment from both sides. Like, I don't think, you know, for Russ's standpoint, like, he hasn't been placed in an ecosystem in which he could really thrive. And for what the Lakers need alongside their stars, like some of his warts, especially offensively, just don't gel with what they have. And you zoom out and you look at just the overall roster construction, like who is the Laker that has been placed in position to succeed this year? Like even LeBron, the year that he's having, he's kind of succeeding in spite of, and even that success comes with an asterisk because look at where the Lakers are in the standings right now. So it's just been, I guess a disappointment is an understatement at this point. As far as the name calling and stuff, I wish, I understand it isn't just because human nature just doesn't work like that for whatever reason, but I just wish that we could get to a point to where someone says, hey, I find this to be disrespectful. And the response is, you know what? I don't want to disrespect people on purpose. That's fine. Just based on how Russ has played this year, like you can talk about the warts that he has displayed on the court without getting into a name that he finds disrespectful. If you don't find it disrespectful, that's fine. It's not your name. You can quibble about why you feel like that was being brought up. But ultimately, if someone says, hey, I'm not comfortable with this, mostly because my family is not comfortable with this. And zooming in a little further, my children do not need to be exposed to this. That should be enough for people to say, all right, fine. At the very least, let me just tweet it instead of yelling it out at games so his family can be comfortable. Like, I don't feel like that should be pushed back on as much as it has been. That's been the weird part of it for me.
I mean, no one gets to choose their nickname, right?
Yeah, that's true.
No, but I'm with you. If he says that he's uncomfortable, like that should just be a hard stop right there.
I mean, like just cite his field goal percentage. Like it's could hit the same.
You said cite his field goal percentage though?
I'm just saying, like if
it's higher than Steph's.
Oh God. Can I say
that's a good shot. That's a good shot. That is a good shot. We are rolling.
Someone had to take one. But I just feel like I've seen that tweet or some version of that tweet like 30 times this year. I'm just like, guys, like the first two or three times, I'm just like, why are we doing this? This is disingenuous. And I'm just like, oh, this is being tweeted because people are saying that it's disingenuous. So I would hope that everyone else is just like, yo, we all know why the field goal percentage is higher. Like that's the entire point. Stop making this go viral. So people stop saying it. It's very annoying. That just gets me into a whole Twitter thing. I'm not
about did that strike a nerve with you? The hashtag is big mad, folks. What's going on?
Man, I just get tired of seeing bait tweets. The same version of bait tweets. And it's just like, stop quote tweeting purposefully bad takes.
You just gotta let it fly by, guys. You just don't have to engage.
Hey, you know, you got your thumb and you just keep scrolling. You just scroll up or down, whichever you want to go. You could, you know, if you swipe up and fast enough, the app will go away, right?
Need that to go away sometimes. All right. Let's dig into the Los Angeles Clippers. Heading into Thursday night's action, they are 35-33, eighth in the West. They are 5-2 since the All-Star break. This is a bottom-tier offense right now, 26th in offensive rating. They are 17th in half-court offense. They are 7th in overall defense, 5th in half-court defense. Let's just start with a very basic question. Sabrina, what has stood out to you the most about this Clipper team?
Their inconsistency. I just never know what is going to happen on any given night with this Clippers team, which is strange because they have a lot of established players who you'd expect. Like you have a baseline of what Reggie Jackson is, what Nico Batum is, what Marcus Morris is. And yet on any given night, they can look awesome and just smack down the Warriors in Golden State. Or they can, you know, fall behind by 30 plus to just a really bad team. And it's just weird how a veteran team like that just doesn't have something that you can like to just dial into any given night. And I know that it frustrates the living hell out of Ty Lue, but that's just what the Clippers are. And I mean, it's not really their fault because their lineup is inconsistent any given night. And when you just don't know who's going to suit up, that is obviously an added challenge. But yeah, to me, that was it because like last season, even without Kawhi Leonard and Paul George available for every game, like there was just a certain barometer of competence that they were hitting every night. And that just it isn't the same way this year. And I get it. Like, there's not two big stars, but mm-hmm. I just figured with more veterans, with the same coaching staff, with another year in the same system, that there'd be just more night to night, like less variability in that sense. And that has kind of surprised me.
Steve, what about you?
Well, I think that that's a great point, the inconsistency, because when you think of the Clippers, you probably in your head, your first thought is, oh, defense. They're a grinding defensive team. They gave up 116 points to the New York Knicks. Okay, without these guys, they can't score in the half court. They'll grind you out. Now, they have nights where they hit a whole bunch of threes and score a whole bunch of points. And then you watch two nights later and it's like, oh, wait, their offense is in a phone booth. And so it's kind of weird to have that. Like, you rarely have the team that doesn't have their stars, but also doesn't have, as was stated, an identity. So where night in, night out, you know exactly what you're going to get. For me, it's I point to Reggie Jackson and Marcus Morris. Just their play in general. The fact that the offense is basically, hey, did those two do stuff? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of working enough to get you in the position you're in. I give a hat tip to that. And also just having all of the wings in the world.
All of the wings. Goodness gracious.
Do we just have all the guys that are the similar size and we've rotated them out. We've gotten rid of some, but we still have those, all of them, and still bigs. So that's been fun.
I would say just macro view, I guess. I've had a lot of fun watching Ty Lue tinker with this group in the different iterations of this group. As Serena mentioned, like, there has been a ton of inconsistency there. But, and maybe this is also colored by me watching Eric Spoelstra all these years and how he's had to tinker with different lineups and stuff. But, like, watching him go, all right, cool, we're going to go big. Now we're going to go without a center. We're going to put a bunch of wings out there. Okay, cool, we're going to go drop. We're going to, as they started in that Knicks game, they end up losing. All right, we're just going to start the game with a 2-3 zone. Let's just see what the Knicks do. Like, Ty Lue has been pressing buttons all year long. And the Clippers have been able to string together 3, 4, 5 wins in a row. And then sometimes the offense dies or the defense isn't there. And they go on losing streaks. I mean, that's kind of, I guess it's expected to an extent just because they are missing their stars. But I think that's been the fun part for me with this Clippers group, just watching Ty Lue try to figure it out. Like, this has been an incredibly tough job for him. And the fact that the Clippers are pretty solidly a play-in team and not too far out of a playoff spot. I don't think they get there, but the fact that they're within striking distance is a testament to the job that he's done. So that's kind of where I start with this Clipper group.
I do have a question I'm going to throw out there to both of y'all. Does that inconsistency and the tinkering that's happened, does it affect how you view them in the play-in, potentially in the playoffs? Or are they still potentially just very pesky and annoying because of what they can bring?
They're super pesky and annoying. I feel like that inconsistency often materializes against opponents who don't exactly capture their attention. So when, you know, when the lights are bright and it's a national TV game, I feel like they show out a lot better than they do on those random Sunday afternoon games against a lesser opponent, which, you know, is not what you want to see from any team. But, like, this is also a team that I would just be deathly terrified of seeing in a play-in or even in the first round if I'm Golden State or Phoenix.
I would not want to see this Clippers team either. Because, I mean, again, Ty Lue's been doing a great job all year long. I don't want to give that time, get a man time.
No.
To concoct something against me. Like, that's just not, I just wouldn't want any part of that. Like, even if there is a talent disadvantage, just again, Paul George is out. Not sure if he's going to come back. Kawhi Leonard is out. I don't think he's going to come back this season. Like, the Suns or the Warriors or even the Grizzlies, if they end up at 2 or whatever, like, they should be able to out-talent the Clippers. But also, there's some scheme versatility there. They got that guy on the sideline. They are pretty boom or bust with their threes, and we'll get into the offense shortly. That just feels like an annoying 6 games waiting to happen against someone.
Extremely.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen him find it and figure it out. And once he figured it out, the whole series shifts. Mm-hmm. And as stated, if they're playing a big team, they're going to be locked in. You give them that opportunity, free playing with free house money in game plan. I don't know, man. Also, Reggie Jackson.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's just Paul George that comes back, like, they nearly beat Phoenix last year with just Paul George. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't think they're going to get their full complement of guys back. I don't think they're going to push Kawhi back into this year's postseason.
On the Clippers front, we've all kind of touched on the inconsistency of this group. If there has been a stable end of the floor for the Clippers this year, it is the defensive end. What have you seen from this Clippers defensive unit this year without Paul George, Kawhi?
I mean, you kind of alluded to it earlier in that they're just willing to try anything, right? Like in the course of a game, you'll see them very, like they'll close small at the end of quarters or the end of halves. They'll, you know, start big. I mean, they've played two big lineups before, although that was primarily before Serge Ibaka was traded at the deadline. They throw in zone sometimes. I mean, Dan Craig comes from Miami, right? Like he loves tinkering. Like this is just a lovely matchup between him and Ty Lue, just wanting to do as many things as possible. But they have good defensive personnel, right? Like I understand that in the starting lineup, Reggie Jackson and Marcus Morris are not the stoutest of defenders. Like their responsibilities lie more on the offensive end of the floor, but Zubac is a good rim protector, right? He deters guys from wanting to take shots. He can kind of hang in a switch with the best of them, unless obviously they're playing Dallas. And then when you have that stable of wings, you can throw in a switching system whenever you want. And you've got Nico and Robert Covington and even Amir Coffey and Terrence Mann and Reggie Jackson, who's got a 7-foot wingspan, even though he's point guard size height-wise. Like there's just so many different things they can do. And Ty is basically adjusting like before the timeout even gets called. So there's no chance for the opposing team's offense to catch up. Like they'll blitz guys and then they'll sag back and they'll put Nico Batum on the other team's center and just have him front and go at it and just dare the other team to like not turn the ball over on entry passes. I mean, there's just a lot of different options that they have available defensively and they try everything. Like there's rarely an instance where you watch and think like, I wish Ty would have done that. Like, no, it happened and they've already moved on to the next thing.
Either it worked or it hasn't. Steve, how have you felt about the defense this year?
I mean, I'd echo a lot of those sentiments. The scheme versatility jumps out the most to me. And in this type of league, especially through injuries, to be able to do those different things at different times, I think it's been big. And that's my their calling card for me in the playoffs. Because whatever your thing is, they're going to be able to take it away. And even if they can't, they have more things in the bag to try. So if we're talking a team like Dallas or something like that with Luka, you can throw multiple things at him. You can throw the zone, keep it in your back pocket. So I just think the importance of that has been so key for them. It's just interesting to see how that's going to work because they're going to play a really good team. But that's kind of the unfortunate part to me because I think they can make things really difficult for Phoenix. Can they win? I don't know. But I think they can make it really interesting. I think they can take a Memphis and be like, hey, all that good stuff you guys are doing the regular season, we're just going to junk all that up. Now what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Like that element that they have, and because of the things they can do defensively, I think it's been huge.
I'm with you. I'll go ahead, Sabrina.
The Phoenix matchup is so interesting to me because you make just one or two mistakes in the half court. Phoenix gets a couple open threes, and I just don't trust the Clippers offense to be able to get into a track meet if that's what it turns into. So you just have to be so perfect because their offense has just not been good enough to carry themselves in these shootout type of games. But I mean, it's interesting. I think I still like the Phoenix matchup better than Memphis for them, honestly, just because of the way their teams are constructed. But I don't want to disrespect Phoenix on this podcast. It's not really my place.
Actually, that's actually an interesting point. Because if Memphis... You mentioned the Clippers offense. If Memphis can guard, they can then run. And if they can run, they will score. And then .. It would have to be the Clippers getting them in the half court.
And Memphis is just so physical. They just bully the Clippers straight up in the half court. And whatever defenses they've tried to throw at the Grizzlies in the last two seasons really just have not been successful. Like every time they play the Grizzlies, it is a rout. It's not even close. And I know that obviously, things change from the regular season to the playoffs, but there's certain just stylistic things about the way the Grizzlies attack the Clippers and the way they put pressure on the rim and just have zero regard for Zubac in the middle. Like, it's just a really bad matchup for LA. That's one that I don't like if I'm a Clipper, if I'm looking at the you know, first round of the playoffs.
Plus, the world has evolved past the need for a Grizzlies-Clippers series.
So has it, though? They're always so much fun.
You got some memories you want to share or?
No, I don't. I don't. Definitely scarred. It's fine. I'll ask this question then.
There were only two, Steve. There were only two.
We only needed two. And I cried after both of them. A win and a loss. It's all right. Don't worry about it. Anyways, see, I'm all rattled. Sabrina, then who do you think would be the matchup that they would want?
I guess among those three, the Warriors, but just because I think that there is some health concern with the Warriors. Like, I'm not sure if you're getting them at their best in the playoffs. And I mean, if Draymond is there then and he's at full strength, then I reserve the right to recant this statement. But the current iteration of the Warriors is just not as scary as what the Grizzlies and the Suns are, even the Suns without Chris Paul. So, and then the Clippers switching just takes the Warriors out of some of the stuff that they're comfortable doing. And they have so many bodies that they can throw out that it's not even like they can switch for parts of the game and then have to play conventionally when they play Zubac or Hartenstein. They can just excise centers from the rotation and have a good 8-player, you know, set that they can throw out the Warriors. And I think that'd be fine. Not that they'd be favored or anything, but I just think that there are ways to handle the Warriors that they haven't proven that they can do against Memphis or even the Suns for consistent stretches this season.
Okay. So if you were ranking the three, you would say as Warriors, Suns, Grizzlies is kind of where you fall?
Right now, yeah.
Okay. Steve, would that be your three?
I would have said Grizzlies one. I'm going to go Suns, Warriors, Grizzlies.
We've evolved past Clippers, Grizzlies.
Man, the Grizzlies have...
Telling you, it's just something about them. They run so fast on the Clippers. Like, there's just... The Clippers' turnover problems are a huge issue against the Grizzlies. More so than against other teams. And just that size in the half court really frustrates the Clippers.
It is interesting. The Clippers are like the rare elite defensive team that also can't rebound. I think they're 25th in rebound rate this year, which is not something you would expect for a team that ranks as highly in defensive rating as they do. But to your point, like Zubac is huge and he's good. And then everyone else is between like 6'3 and 6'7 or 6'8. So you do face a front line like Memphis. I can understand where Steven Adams is just a monster. Jaren isn't a great rebound, but like he is long and lanky and rangy and can move and get you in transition. So I guess I'm being talked into Memphis being a tougher matchup. Like coming in, I would have thought, okay. And Steve and I have talked about this on the podcast. Like, what is Memphis's half-court offense going to look like in the playoffs? Because they are a team that ranks highly in offensive rating this year as well, but the half-court offense is bottom third in the league. And it's like, okay, if it does slow down, if they do face a switch-heavy team like the Clippers, I mean, they do a little bit of everything, but primarily they switch a ton. Like, what does that look like? But honestly, you swayed me a little bit. Like, there is an athleticism gap. The history is the history. And the turnover issue is a turnover issue. Like, I think that's where you would need at least one of those stars to come back just to kind of settle the offense down to make that a more palatable matchup. Because right now, and I guess we can segue into this, on the offensive side, how have you felt about Reggie Jackson's season this year?
He's had to do a lot, like a lot of things around Reggie Jackson's plate. He's the only point guard on the roster at this point. Like there's some Amir Coffey running pick and roll. There's some Terrence Mann running things in transition. But basically when Ty Lue is concerned about scoring points, Reggie Jackson's on the court, which means if they're in games that they're trying to win, he's playing like 38 plus minutes, which does not feel sustainable for his shooting percentages. And it's clear when you look at his shooting percentages that it has not been the ideal role for Reggie Jackson. It's just, he's so much fun when he gets going and he starts galloping and, you know, he's skipping up and down the court and like those nifty little reverse finishes that he gets. And when his jumper is working, like it's very easy to root for Reggie Jackson. And then there are the games like the Knicks game when he, I don't know, what was he like 1-for-12 from the floor? Like there, it can get really bad for him, but he's the only guy on the Clippers without Paul George who can settle the offense at all. Like otherwise, like Steve said, it looks like they're stuck in a phone booth. Like they're just, nothing is happening. He's the only guy who gets consistent pressure on the rim in the half court. Like, and consistent is like, you know, going overboard with the way Reggie Jackson attacks the rim. But he's the only guy who like can get pressure on the rim in the half court. He's just being asked to do way too much. And that's why, like we were talking about earlier, like the consistency with the Clippers basically depends on, is Reggie having a good game or is he not? And it's nothing that the Clippers are doing schematically different to enable Reggie. I think most of the time it's just, is the jumper working? Is it not working? And if it is, then that just opens things up for everyone else. And if it's not, then oh boy, are there problems on their offense.
I don't feel like this season has been fair to him. I was actually talking about this in a group chat a little bit earlier today. I was like, Reggie Jackson is in paradise and is also way overtasked. Like, I feel like this is the kind of role that he would want. Like, hey, put the game on me. Let me control the flow. Let me get my shots up. Let me set things up. But also, you see why that isn't his ideal role. Because he does have a pull-up dependent shot diet. He can get to the rim, doesn't get all the way there that often. There are some warts as a playmaker. So it's kind of on him to knock down those shots. And he's relied on so much without those two wings. Like, things, the offense already kind of feels a little bogged down. And if he doesn't have it going, it can kind of snowball very quickly. And I feel bad saying that because I recognize that this is not his ideal role. And he has had to carry a burden that he shouldn't have to. And he's doing the best he can in said role.
And he never sits. He's only missed COVID games this year.
It's a ridiculous responsibility.
Yeah. And they know that they're riding him hard, but there are just no options when, like, Eric Bledsoe isn't even available to run a second unit. Like, there's just nobody else who can reliably run an offense for more than a couple of possessions at a time. I mean, like, they use Isaiah Hartenstein basically as a second unit point guard sometimes, right? Like, that's what they have to do when Reggie's off the court. I mean, Ty likes to say, like, they just got a lot of people who can eat and no one who can cook, right? Like, that's just what they're running with on their offense. And he's the only guy who can set anybody up. So it's too much. Like, when Paul George comes back, everything just settles down for Reggie. But again, if and when.
Yeah, he should just be, I feel like Reggie should be like the exclamation point of the offense. Like, we have the shots going. We have like the guy we ordered around, whether it's Kawhi or PG. And then, oh wait, now we also have to deal with a 14-point Reggie Jackson quarter versus Reggie, we need you to be the bellwether of the offense.
Yeah, you just need one. You just need one of them to make Reggie look better. But being the number one option is just not, it's not where he is at this point of his career.
Yeah, it's been tough sledding for him. Steve, where are you on your guy Reggie? I feel like this has been tough for you to listen to.
I will never disrespect Reggie Jackson. I learned that lesson very quickly.
I think we've also graduated beyond Grizzlies Thunder series.
Nope. Not me. Tell you that much. I can still remember the headline in the newspaper when they made fun of KD. But Reggie Jackson, and yes, we have evolved past that as well. Reggie Jackson is not supposed to be the offense. As y'all have mentioned, he's supposed to be a feature, not the whole game mode. So this is a lot of asking him not just to run the show, but also be him, but have to be him. Like, hey, those shots, take them, but we need you to make them. If you don't make them, we're in trouble. You know, and the problem is, even when he's hot, it's not necessarily changing how defenses guard him. It's not like it's going to open plays up. You're just banking on him to hit those to allow these other plays to happen. Or when your set breaks down, hey, Reggie, come off a pick or attack off the bounce or make something happen. I think that's been if I pull it past Reggie, that's been the interesting part about the Clippers offense. I've always had questions about the movement and the flow, even with Kawhi and PG. But without them, it's intriguing that they're trying to get movement, but it doesn't have the same impact. So you're basically running, flex or moving the ball for 10, 15 seconds, or you're posting up Marcus Morris from the start, putting him at the elbow, or it's Reggie run a pick and roll. We didn't get anything. Let's move it. So it's like they're trying to use their wings as creators, but they can't get paint touches. So they can't always get drive and kick shots. They don't have pick and roll automatic every time, you know? So they try dribble handoffs. It might work. You know, Coffee might turn the corner. Man might turn the corner, get in the paint. And then it doesn't if you switch or something like that. Now
I think it goes back to what we were talking about as far as the inconsistency, where it's just a wheel. Like, it's a wheel of what's the problem now? How do we fix it? Where do we go? Wait. No. Reggie, make a shot.
Yeah.
Okay, let's figure it out.
Just to add to that, like, the handoffs have been interesting. As I spent the day watching or going back over some of their post-All-Star break games, and it's just like Isaiah Hartenstein comes in the game, and like, he's the most creative element of the half-court offense. And even within, it's just, all right, cool, we're just going to spam delay. We're going to do some splits. And watching him hit cutters is fun. It's also hilarious when he misses a pass. Or there was a play towards the end of the, I want to say the first Lake, it was either the first Laker game or the Rockets game, in which Luke Kennard cuts. This is fourth quarter play. Luke Kennard cuts and he just kind of stops. And Isaiah Hartenstein whips a pass and it just flies out of bounds. And the frustration on his face where he's like, why did you stop? What are you doing? I'm just like, he's seeing the floor. Isaiah Hartenstein is having a fun year. I love watching that bad play.
Harden dimes.
There we go. It is weird that he hasn't stuck anywhere until now.
He hasn't really had any good fits. Yeah. Like, he started in Houston right when they decided to go centerless. Then he goes to Denver and he's Nikola Jokic's backup, and no one survives as Nikola Jokic's backup because the minute you do something wrong, Jokic is back on the court. And then he goes to Cleveland where they decide to draft Evan Mobley and sign Jared Allen to a mammoth extension. So, you know.
This is the one, and now he's with the Clippers, in which they now have like seven different small ball center options if they want to go to it.
Yeah. He did change his agent so that he's repped as the same guy as Paul George and Reggie Jackson and Luke Kennard. So, you know, seems like he wants to stay.
There we go. Smart.
See how that pans out.
That's a business decision right there.
That is a business decision.
I respect it. One thing that kind of stood out to me as I did like a basic stat research starting my dive today. At least since the All-Star break, the minute split at center has pretty much been even between him and Zubac. Like, how have you felt about how the center room has been handled this year?
It's a good question. I'm glad it's back down to two without the necessity of trying to play Ibaka for those third center minutes, because that was just getting no fun for anyone. Nobody was happy about that. Hart's just fun. You know, like you said, he's just a little more dramatic really than anybody else on the Clippers. Like, he tries to do stuff that nobody else really wants to do. He and Kennard have a great little chemistry off those handoffs. And like you said, the cuts too. I think if Hartenstein can stay out of foul trouble, then he just provides a little more offensive oomph that Zubac, not that he can't, is
it's
just a less willing scorer, I think, than Hart is. Like, Hart wants to make things happen on offense that Zubac is just has never been his style. The problem is that you don't want to start every quarter like getting into the bonus right away because Hartenstein commits like three touch fouls. So that's really the thing that has been limiting his minutes for most of the season. But I think it's the right fit, because Zoo gets a little worse the longer he plays. He's not a guy who's built to play 30 plus minutes, for better or worse, you know. And there are matchups that'll demand more of him than they will from Isaiah. But I like the split, because that bench unit with Hartenstein and Mann and Kennard works really well together. They just have a nice, there's like some flow there that doesn't exist on the rest of the Clippers offense. If you can maximize their minutes together, that trio, I think it's just best for everyone involved. And so long as, again, Hart's just not getting in foul trouble, like, the defense is fine. Like, his defensive splits are insane, actually. Anecdotally, watching him, I don't feel like he's that much better than Zubac. Like, I like Zubac's rim protection instincts better, but the numbers are ridiculous with Isaiah on the court.
Thank you. Because like, one of the things that stood out to me early on, I was like, wait a minute. Because I come in, I was like, all right, I know what Zubac does defensively as a rim protector. Like, surely fewer shots allowed to rim, worse field goal percentage. Then I look at the split and I'm just like, wait a minute. Why is this worse?
So much worse.
This is like, okay, then it's just a second year thing. And I look at Isaiah Hartenstein's numbers, like, this does not pass the smell test for me. And I watch
him.
Like,
good.
Okay, yeah, like he's fine. Like, they seem more willing to play him higher up than they do with Zubac, but even he's still mostly in a drop and like contest well, contest with verticality. Like, he does the thing, but I'm just like, he's not this, surely. But that also got the gears turning. Like, wait, if he may not be this elite number, but if he is solid and he gives them a level of improvisation offensively that they need right now with their stars. Like, do we get to a point to where the minutes are just even? Or there's a justification to play Isaiah Hartenstein more? And now it's like, okay, maybe Nikai, you're just being ridiculous right now. So let me ask the actual expert here.
I don't think we've gotten to a point where Isaiah's going to be closing games over Zoo or a small ball lineup. I just don't think that Ty trusts his decision-making, you know? Because he's a little bit more careless with the ball, right? Like the fouls are a little bit out of control. But as far as just, you know, playing 20-ish minutes, like, I definitely think he's earned that.
How do we feel about Zubac's year this year?
I mean, what were we expecting from Zoo this year?
He's been good to me.
He's been paid $7 million annually on this current contract. I think that's a steal for what he's providing for the Clippers. He doesn't miss games. He is a above average rim protector. He was making his free throws before the season. I don't want to get the stat wrong. I don't know if he's shooting well, but he's got the most ugly hook shot I've ever seen that still goes in, you know, when you dump the ball into him. In terms of rim pressure, like, he actually does roll to the basket and do something in that regard. So I just think you're getting like what you pay for with Zoo, and even more, just, you know, he's not going to be like an above average center when you account for both ends of the floor.
Okay. Because I was wondering, is this a point where this is just who he is? Or is this a point where he's just been impacted by those other guys being out for so long, to where maybe some of the things he could add offensively don't pop the same because defenses are like, look at who's coming off.
Yeah.
You can just roll right into me. I'm fine. You know?
I'm inclined to think this is more of who he is, but he's young enough. Like, he's only 25, so he's young enough to where he could still keep growing and I wouldn't be surprised. But given all of the personnel absences that the Clippers have had, the fact that they don't try to get Zoo to do more makes me think that they don't expect him to do more either.
That's a fair point right there. Go ahead.
Oh, you finish.
Clearing out. Ask.
Just on the Zubac offense question, I was just going to ask how you feel about his passing, because it feels a little bit better to me on the rare occasion that he gets like a short roll opportunity, because teams don't blitz Clipper ball handlers that often. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the processing is a little bit better there. Has that been your experience?
I haven't noticed as much this season because, like you said, he's not really facing a lot of 4-on-3 situations because no one is demanding two of the ball when they run a pick and roll. It's something I noticed a lot of last year, that when he was running pick and roll with Kawhi and PG, like, head on the swivel thing was happening. He was finding shooters in the corners. Like, I mean, the Clippers shot absurd from three last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was hitting some of those guys. So it's just a situation where I haven't seen it much this year because the opportunity hasn't really presented itself. But, and then the problem is that he's like compared to Isaiah Hartenstein as a passer, and he just doesn't have the flair that Isaiah does. But I do think that passing out of the short roll is something that's definitely in his bag. It requires someone to create the 4-on-3 situation. And for all of Reggie Jackson's gifts, he's not doing that much this season.
Yeah, I'm just in a tough place with the Clipper offense in general. Cause like within the context of Zoo, like, I would like for him to get those opportunities, but like, you're also not getting anyone that's forcing the defense to scramble in that way. Like, whenever I feel like the Clippers are getting a good bit of drop, and I don't know why they're getting dropped, because if I'm heading into a game with the Clippers, I'm just switching everything. Like, I'm just not going to give you a gap to attack, because I feel like Reggie Jackson getting hot is giving him pockets to pull up into. If you're trying to find stuff for Terrence Mann or Amir Coffey, it's giving them a gap to fly into. I would just force those guys to create. So I don't know. Like, it's,
like, Amir Coffey got a week of drop and now it switches. Like, he doesn't get drop anymore. Once the book came out on Amir Coffey, that he's not facing that anymore. Maybe it's just like teams just don't switch on the reg, you know, like, it's not their MO to go into a game thinking that they're going to switch everything unless it's a specific ball handler. But I mean, with Reggie Jackson, like, I feel like he just dribbles up into pull-ups regardless of what kind of coverage is facing him. Like, that's just his shot diet. So
yeah.
Do you need to stretch yourself defensively to take away that shot, or do you just stick with your base and then hope that it's not one of those nights for Reg?
I think teams lean more towards that second thought. Hey, let's go with our base. Let's see what they have. And then if we need to adjust, we will, or we hope this doesn't beat us. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to get into rotation and open up a play for them. And switching is something that I think if more teams were doing it regularly, I think they would see it more. But I think it's just easier to stay drop, stay consistent. We don't have to over-rotate. We don't have to worry about matchups.
There's never been a better time.
Here we go. The big time Nikias again. The third pod in a row with this man.
No, it's just an ad. I pulled up a B-ball reference page.
The hashtag is big time, folks.
Whatever happened to Big Juice? Is that still a thing? You still got that sponsorship coming through, Nikias?
He got the juice. Didn't send me any, but he got the juice.
What a disaster.
Wow. Why am I on trial right now? This isn't about me.
It's the dunker spot. What do you expect?
Fair enough.
How do we feel about Terrence Mann's season? Has he taken lumps? Is this what it's supposed to be as a young player developing? Are we reading too much? Is the drives doing well? Is he having the impact he was supposed to have? Or is this a lot role-wise for him in this moment?
I like what Terrence Mann has been able to do defensively this year. I think he gets lost less. He's more sound schematically. That was something that I think got a little overshadowed last year with his offensive breakout, was that he was getting attacked a lot on the other end. And that's not happening as much this year. I think the Clippers have actually been able to deploy him as something of a stopper on smaller guys too. And it's gone okay. Like year three of Terrence Mann has been quite the improvement defensively from year two. He was never going to be able to live up to the offensive expectation that was created by game six against Utah. It was an unreasonable expectation. I mean, he scored 39 points in that game and then did not score 20 points until February of this year. So it's a big gap. He's just not a half court scorer, and the Clippers don't run very well. Like, that is an understatement. They're a horrific transition team. It's gotten a little bit better as the season has gone on, but they make some weird ass decisions in transition. And Terrence Mann is one of the guys who was responsible for that. So I think he's given more opportunities to score on the break than he is in the half court. Like, they don't run anything for him in the half court. They just tell, he gets the ball, and like, if it's a compromised defense and maybe he'll attack if he finds a seam or something, but no plays are being run for him in the half court. If he is being tasked as a scorer, it's in transition, and the overall Clippers transition ecosystem has just not been very healthy. So I think it's good to see him, you know, making strides on one side of the court. At least the offense has, you know, it's not gone the way I thought it was going to, but I don't really think that there's anything here that like precludes him taking a jump next year. You know, like, the shooting has still been relatively consistent. The finishing is blah, but you know, that's also because the Clippers just have a blah offense, and that means that defenses can load up on the rim and prevent him from getting the kind of shots he wants. And then he also has like this increased fondness for the Dirk jumper, which I don't understand, because like, that's just a weird thing to bust out in year three when you're not like a scorer with a capital S. So he's still supremely confident in his offensive ability. It hasn't gone as well as I'm sure people would have hoped, but it's very much like a stepwise approach here, right? Like, they're focusing on one thing at a time, or let's let Terrence become a guy who can grab and go first, and then we'll let him get into the half court part of things. And we're just not at the half court part of things yet.
That's all fair. Like, I don't want to keep hammering this point home, but like, it just feels like he's also like a victim of circumstance. But I feel like he is, I think between him and Amir, honestly, like, they feel like the two most decisive half court players that they have. And so ideally they're just shooting open jumpers, which on the man front, I still feel like he passes up quite a few. And I wish he would have a more willing trigger from deep. But it's like, okay, I'm going to shoot, or I'm going to move the ball, or I'm going to attack this closeout. And they just don't have closeouts to attack consistently. And so
those closeouts are short.
Yeah. Also that. It's like the defense isn't tilted enough for him to attack consistently, I guess is my main point. So like, if he isn't grabbing and going, or if he isn't the guy bringing the ball up to call the play and then just stand in the corner. Like, it just feels like he's just not involved. So I don't, he feels better on that end, but he hasn't had enough opportunity to show that he's better, if that makes sense. It's kind of my read from with him.
My thing with Man is it feels like on those kickouts that he gets, he's driving either into a short closeout or he's driving into help. And that's a difficult thing to manage. So he's trying to drive and kick, but he's not like, it's not like anyone's leaving the shooters open. And I feel like, I wonder how much of that is an evolution as well, as far as teams understanding, okay, y'all's drives are to open something up. We're going to stay home. Now, what are you going to do?
Give the ball back to Reggie.
But I mean, it's the Clippers offense is hilarious because if you look at that starting lineup, the movement guy is all of a sudden Marcus Morris Sr. I think about setting staggers for Marcus Morris. He'd almost be better off just giving it to him at the elbow, but then you can't start that way. So, you know what I mean?
They try it.
It's like where is our starting point? You know, Batum has a bunch of things he can do, but you know, how do you start with him? If you start with Reggie, you're probably going to end with Reggie, but then you're probably going to end with Reggie anyways. Tyloo's got some work. He's been doing some work, man.
He really has. I'm glad you brought up Batum. He's had such a good year when he's been available. Like, I just shouted out Al Horford on the last pod for what he's been able to do and what he's been tasked with. Like, Batum's getting tough matchups at this stage, and he's switching all over the place, and he's also playing the five. I didn't know how it. Just watching games today, watching him at five running pick and roll with Reggie Jackson and him popping against a drop and just not getting the ball. Like Reggie just hunting out the late switch. I'm just like, bro, please feed the man. He's working out there. But I just wanted to say Dick deserves his flowers. He's been fun.
Was the basis of this whole episode to just slander Reggie Jackson? I just got to know for me.
No, it wasn't.
Peace of mind helps.
The poor Clippers ran this promotion for him yesterday that they were going to throw out peanut butter and jelly bites when he got to the free throw line, and he didn't get free throws until the 48th minute of the game.
Oh no.
They just have these boxes of peanut butter and jelly bites.
That's kind of tough.
In hindsight, it's really the Clippers' fault for choosing Reggie Jackson, who notoriously does not get to the free throw line.
Yeah, you gotta.
But then, who would you choose if that's your promotion on the Clippers? Honestly, Zoo.
I was just about to say, you know, getting fouled after offensive rebounds, like that's got to be the one.
Was this the last game they played?
Yeah, the one against Washington last night.
They shot a total of 13 free throws.
Yep. Sounds like a very Clippers game to me. I got to tell you.
With Marcus Morris leading the way with four, so
that is not ideal.
Maybe they need to do like a promo for
a long week. Two promo.
A pull-up promo.
Jesus, they certainly have the personnel for that.
Yeah, Luke could get in on that. Reggie, Marcus, good stuff. Yeah,
we love it. Shout out Luke Kennard for like taking threes this year. Ty Lue finally got to him.
According to Luke, he still gets told all the time that he's not taking enough.
He's such a good shooter.
Just jack that volume up.
I don't get what the hesitation is.
He has one of the best looking jump shots I've ever seen. It's beautiful.
Just a smooth lefty flick that he can get to off movement, out of pick and roll, obviously the spot ups. Like, he shouldn't have a game unless he like gets hurt or like two techs for some weird reason. Like, he shouldn't have a game under like 5 or 6 3-point attempts. It shouldn't happen.
Agreed. Agreed.
He's very
good. He opens up a lot on their offense because like Steve was saying, like he's the movement shooter, right? He's the one who you can like actually set screens for and bend the defense with in a way that the other shooters on the Clippers who like even if their percentages are high just don't have that kind of ability in the half court.
I agree. One last Clipper question before we move. We've talked about and around Ty Lue throughout this entire segment. Where would you have him in the coach of the year race?
It's a good question. Good question. I don't think he's going to make my ballot. It's top three, right?
Yeah, I think it's three for coach of the year.
Yeah. I don't think he'd make the ballot, which is weird because like I think he's a top two coach in the league, but I don't know if he's a top three coach of this particular season. The Clippers have just been too weird for my taste for him to be a top three coach of the year candidate.
I feel you. Steve, where do you land on that?
I think Ty Lue deserves a tip of the cap, and I think he'll have an opportunity to showcase why he is so highly regarded in the play-in and playoff. I don't know if he would hit my top 10 in coach of the year voting.
Not top 10.
Okay.
Not that he's not a top 10 coach.
Do you have the 10 listed, Steve?
We need the list.
Do you? I feel like there's slander involved, but I got you. Don't worry about it. Monty Williams. Mm-hmm. Is someone counting, by the way?
Yes.
All right, cool. Monty Williams, Spo, JB Bickerstaff. Mm-hmm. I'm at three, right?
Yes.
A good ballot.
Doc. I could have pulled up my file. It's fine. Don't worry about it, guys. Live content. Did I say Billy Donovan?
No.
You have not.
Them. Ime Udoka.
Okay.
I say Glenn.
You already said Doc, yes.
Yeah, Taylor. Taylor Jenkins.
Okay.
I'm going to go Jason Kidd.
All right.
Coach Michael Malone.
Okay.
I'm at nine, right?
Yes.
Oh, this is where it gets tough. Oh, Budenholzer. There you go.
I'm surprised it took to get Ime Udoka until sixth. I thought he would have come earlier.
I was trying to remember what my actual order was.
With what I've learned from this podcast over the last 2 months.
I was feeling the heat because I was trying to actually figure out, wait, did I go too far with 10 in the middle of it? Because I didn't have the math. And I was like, am I going to have to say Quinn Snyder here?
Me? Quinn's been good. Also,
Quinn's good. Yeah. I have a hard time with Quinn.
I recognize this is very much leaning into the bit. Has Doc done a better job than Ty Lue this year? I don't know.
Yes. They're second in the East. Stop.
Did we watch this game today?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, gosh. You remind me of the person who came into my mentions and said, yo, Ty Lue wouldn't have had this team in this position, and I'm just confused as to how this happened.
I'm just glad you brought up Glenn and Doc for your top 10 rankings.
I respect. You wanted to make sure that he got level on the podcast. That was my favorite part.
I'm trying to make up for Nikias, who's been slandering this man for ages, which is okay, though. It's all right.
Yeah, I mean, I cover the Clippers. This is par for the course here.
So, that's where I'm at with that.
I just had some questions for you. That's all.
Where'd you have him, Nikias?
I think Lou is in like the 5-6 range for me. Like, I don't know if I'd have him top three. Outside of top 10, though.
All right, well, then give me your six, sir. Let's put you on the pressure cooker. I got fingers, too. Let's go. I'm right here.
Oh, man. But no, I think Spo is still one for me right now. But Spo, Bickerstaff, Jenkins. Before I continue, I don't know what to do with Billy Donovan yet.
Where is Monty, Nikias?
I've blanked on Monty. Like, Monty's in there as well.
Oh, I was so totally hoping he would forget about Monty on this list. You have no idea how much I was just
Chris
waiting.
Paul, oh. Coach of the Year vote over here.
There we go. If I remember him, then I remember him. And if I don't, it just lands into the Chris Paul bit. No losses here. It's fine. But those four for sure. Billy Donovan kind of has the asterisk because, like, one, he has overachieved in my eyes. Like, I don't know how fair of a barometer that is. Like, I could just be wrong versus him overachieving, but he has. But also, the Bulls are sliding because they're hurt and stuff. So now it's just like, if they have this kind of year and then they end up in like six because of the injuries, then it's like, what do we do with the coach of the year case? So that's odd for me.
So we're at five. That means Tyler is next. Or like, is Billy not on it?
I don't think I probably have Billy a tier below. Like, I think Ty at five probably fits for me. Those four and Ty.
Who was your preseason coach of the year pick?
Ime Udoka was.
Okay. Just curious.
He's also up there. He is.
I think Monty, Spo, JB is like a pretty unimpeachable top three ballot. Yeah. Whatever order you want to go in.
I had the coach of the year a lot tighter earlier. I think Monty is just run away with it. Like, I don't even know what the argument is at this point.
I'm so mad that he didn't win last year.
He should have won last year, but it's okay. If he wins it this year, that would be very cool.
So are we going Unoka or Thibodeau?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that does it. Let's get into some W talk. We had a trade earlier this week. Tierra McCowan is now a Dallas wing. She's going to Dallas, the number 7 overall pick of this year's draft is going to Dallas, as well as Chicago's 2023 first round pick. And the Fever are getting the 4th and 6th overall picks this year and Dallas's first round pick for next year. Two questions. One, how do you feel about the Orike and McCowan combo, theoretically? And two, what exactly are the Fever trying to do?
It is so many picks involved in a trade for one player. It is an astounding number of picks. Like, yeah, to trade first rounders in the same draft for consecutive years is so weird to me. But I have no idea what Dallas is doing, first of all. You have drafted a center at number 1 last year. You drafted a center at number 2 last year. And now you're bringing in Tierra McCowan, who doesn't exactly fit the fun run and gun thing that you had going last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess if Vicky Johnson just wants to run horns on every single offensive set, then yeah, Tierra McCowan's your girl. But I am confused by the allocation of resources here. I didn't look at the wings and think, hey, what they really need is a big bruising center who can get more rebounds. That just wasn't my takeaway from watching last year's Dallas Wings. So that's whatever it is with Dallas. As far as Indiana, I mean, this is a classic clean house, right? Like, every single person who was associated with the previous regime is basically gone. They're just adding more and more picks. They get what, a net first in this deal. And it basically turns Chicago's first next year into Dallas's first. And there's a much better chance of Dallas's first being a lottery first than Chicago's. So you're just taking a chance on Dallas being a little bit worse, which I think is a reasonable gamble, right? Like, of all the playoff teams that could take a step back, Dallas seems like an easy test case for one of them. So yeah, that's just Indiana. Like, okay, nothing has worked the last 5 years, so let's just completely wipe the slate and try over. I mean, Tierra McCowan's going to be up for an extension soon, so I guess you're just clearing the books, but I like McCowan a lot. I think she has a place on a non-Dallas team in this league. I just don't really understand the fit when you've got Charlie Collier, when you've got Awakwuir, when you've got Isabel Harrison, who I think is really nice on that team too. Just a weird decision by Dallas. And ultimately, I don't think like it changes the upper tier of the W that much, but still just a weird thing to come to your inbox.
Do you think Vicky sees... Like, this feels like if they end up starting McCowan, like, I don't know if they will, but like, if they do, like, is this just a gamble / admission that Charlie Collier can really shoot and they think that their front court can work in that way?
Oh, I just assumed it was going to be in place of Collier. Yeah, who would they start? Because you start Satu and Tierra McCowan together, right? And then you would put like Alicia Gray, Marina Mabry, and Enrique in the backcourt.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like a fine lineup. It's just 4 of those players seem to play one style of basketball, and then you've got McCowan. But I mean, I guess like it's not such a bad thing to extend some possessions with offensive rebounds, but Arike is just getting to the hoop no matter what, like whether you set a screen for her or not. So do you really need somebody clogging the paint when she's trying to finish there? Like, I don't know.
To play a counter, I guess it'd be nice to be able to have that post option. Dive, throw in there every now and then, maybe mix it in. But I don't, when you have that amount of players that play similar positions but also play differently, I am confused. Confused mostly by this trade because, like, man, the W, it's like, how many top picks is Indiana just going to be like,
no thanks?
That's also the weird thing about so many picks being traded. Like, they can't roster all of these picks. But like, even in a vacuum, okay, we cleared the decks, we got picks, but like, what does that really do? Like, I feel like if anything, you just package those to move up if you don't land somewhere you like in the lottery.
Does the Fever just have the whole first round at this point?
They've got 4 first round picks. Yeah. They can't keep all of them. I don't understand the logic.
I'm confused. Like, who do they target?
Oh, I forgot Bella Allery's on Dallas too. That's a lot of centers.
Everyone, anyone and everyone. They're just trying to get anybody at this point. Anybody? Also, I like Sabrina's point because they did clear house, but also like Lynn Dunn is still there. Helping out right now, which is hilarious in a sense.
I don't understand Indiana. Like all of the talent that exists in the WNBA, how hard it is to keep a roster spot. And you look at the Indiana roster and it's like anonymous. It's so strange.
It's the guards and then good luck.
Good luck. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's move out.
Who knows, the Sparks are still going to blow some games to the Fever next year too. It's going to kill me.
A beautiful segue into the new look Sparks, who now have Kennedy Carter and also Liz Cambage and also Jordan Canada. What are your expectations with this group?
I hope we get allowed back into locker rooms because that's going to be fun.
A lot of personalities on that group.
Lot of personality. I mean, Kennedy and Liz are better from a talent perspective than the people who were manning their positions for the Sparks last year. Like that is, I think, like an objective truth. But like Liz couldn't get along with Asia Wilson. Is she going to get along with NECA? Is she going to get along with Derek Fisher? Kennedy Carter, obviously, like her situation in Atlanta has been well documented. She did not finish out the season. I don't think she's going to be starting for the Sparks. I think Jordan Canada is going to get that job to begin with. And so is she going to be okay coming off the bench? I don't really know. But in a perfect world where everyone's egos exist harmoniously, I love the idea of some Kennedy Carter, Liz Cambage, pick and pop. Kennedy can get anywhere she wants on the court and she can shoot. Liz actually rebounds the ball, which is kind of nice for a Sparks team that does not just like anywhere on the court. And that talent upgrade is massive considering where the Sparks were last year. Like there was just so many games where you were looking at the Sparks and it was a lot of Erica Wheeler pick and pop with like Amanda Zowie B, and you can, I guess that's like a functional idea of an offense, but it's not that much fun and it's relies on a lot of things going well. And now the Sparks just have options, right? Like you can run some high low with NECA and Liz. You can play one big if you want and just spread out with like Sykes and Katie Lou and Jasmine Walker on the wings. There's a lot of dribble penetration with Jordan Canada and Kennedy Carter. Chrissy Tolliver is still around, I guess, you know, shooting away. There's a lot that can be done with this roster. And just again, from a talent perspective, it's so much more fun than what happened a year ago. I just have concerns about what it's all going to look like because in the Derek Fisher era, the Sparks have had very talented teams. Mm-hmm. And I would not say that they've had the prettiest offenses. So will that once again be the case? I don't know.
I have a take just to anger Steve, but I'm going to save it. I too have questions about these Sparks. I just want to see how that roster fits. I'll just leave it there.
I mean, I think you could keep it pretty simple and like still have like a 7th or 8th ranked offense, you know, just by like feeding the ball to Liz and running some big and roll and some post-ups, and like it doesn't have to be that complicated, but like there's opportunity for more and I would love to see it, but I don't know if we will.
Jury's out. Steve, were you about to hop in?
No, I was just going to say keeping it simple may be what happens and that may not work out as well as it could. Because that talent upgrade is there. But if you don't use the pieces right, did it matter?
At least there are some people who can hit a jump shot. Like Katie Lou can hit a jump shot. Liz, you know, not like her forte, but she can space a little bit. Kennedy can shoot. I've been told that Jasmine Walker can shoot. I don't know if that's the case. We'll find out. Only a second-year player. She tore her ACL in game 2 of last season. So the Sparks offense last year might have been the worst offense I've ever seen a professional basketball team run. It was horrific. And like, we talked about like Clippers transition, what was earlier, like in a different ballpark than what the Sparks were doing in transition, honestly. And they forced so many turnovers that you'd think, oh, this is like the one part of their offense that could actually work. Did not. I don't need to watch Taya Cooper take layups anymore. I just don't. I don't want to see it. But there's a lot of talent here. And I think there is a playoff team in here, but I am trying not to get my hopes up.
The Sparks have scarred you. That's tough.
Did you watch the Sparks last year, guys? I don't blame you if you didn't, but
I was able to catch some games, and yeah. I understand where the frustration comes from. I'll put it that way. Oh, the take I was going to let off is that Derek Fisher is just the W's Doc Rivers. That might just be. I just needed it for that face from Steve. look, I'm still mad at him benching Candace. Like, that doesn't.
Candace was not good in that game. Okay. She was not good in that game. Chelsea Gray was also benched. Alana Beard was also benched.
It all went haywire.
Speaking of haywire, the Mercury are rising.
There we go. This is how we do professional podcasting.
Is it still in retrograde or no?
You know what? You got it. I can't believe we let that fly. Absolutely not. Anyway, Tina Charles and Diamond DeShields in Phoenix. One, I just want to see Diamond. Last season was so weird for her. Just in and out of the lineup. Didn't feel like she caught her rhythm at all last season. So I'm curious to see what her fit is going to be there. But I would imagine Phoenix is in the upper tier for you.
Assuming they get their starting center back, then yes.
Just a solid size question mark there.
Yes.
That situation is terrifying.
Yeah. The roster that they have assembled, though, I like quite a bit. Griner was outstanding last year. Whether we're talking Phoenix or, international play too, she's very used to playing next to another big, especially one who can score, right? Like, she played next to Asia a lot during the Olympics. Tina Charles also played the four during the Olympics. Admittedly, the U.S. is not playing real competition during the Olympics, at least not to the level they're playing in, the W, but the idea makes sense to me of her playing next to Tina Charles. I'm curious how the Tina Brianna Turner fit works. I love Brianna Turner. I'm sad that she's going to get fewer minutes. Like, that little lob play that she and Skylar Diggins-Smith run is so much fun. And she can guard just a lot of people. And her rebounding is so important because for all the things Griner does, like, last season was the first one where she was an above average rebounding center. So that's the one thing that makes me a little sad. There's just a lot of cooks. And so someone's going to get squeezed. But that front court is impressive. And if Diamond, like, the problem is they need her to be Kia Nurse. And Diamond is not Kia Nurse. Like, she's not just going to stand there and take threes or, she can take the primary defensive matchup. I don't know how well it's going to go, but, like, I don't know who they think Diamond DeShields is in terms of this Phoenix roster. But she wanted to be there. So maybe that counts for something. And again, like, it's definitely a lot of talent.
Like, I feel like if she's right, of course, like, she does inject a level of athleticism that they didn't have.
Especially if you're taking Bree out of the starting lineup.
Yeah. But she can juice the transition attack by herself. And I think taking any pressure off of that half-court offense would be welcome. Not that it's going to be bad. Because, again, as you mentioned, if Brittany Griner is back, and hopefully she will be soon, if she's back, like, there's a hub. Tina Charles is a hub. We know what Diana Taurasi can do. So just being able to manufacture a few easy buckets and transition that way, I think would take take a little bit of pressure off there. So I'm curious to see what that's going to look like. I do want to see how they dole out the front court minutes. It works some magic. I read a roundtable that you did for Squish Appeal in which you listed the Seattle Storm as your free agency winners, one, do you hold firm to that opinion after everything that's transpired in free agency? And two, what is your reasoning for having Seattle as your winner?
So they had three free agents that they needed to re-sign. Four of them, if we count Mercedes Russell, that she was restricted. So I don't always include her in that basket. And they got all three of them. So that's a big win because you signed three of the best players on the market. And they added Breon January, who I think allows them to play some of those three-guard lineups with her, Bird, and Jewel Lloyd. That just saves Jewel a little bit because when Bird is out, like Jewel had to do a lot last year. There was just too much on her shoulders in terms of guarding the best perimeter player and then also generating offense too. I mean, I just thought that Seattle had the best team in the league last year before Stewie got hurt. And I stand by that. And they brought back basically the same team plus Breon January in place of Jordan Canada, who it's great that Canada hits jumpers in the playoffs, but like a player who can consistently hit threes just makes more sense in that Seattle offense than what Canada was doing. Mm-hmm. So I just like their team a lot and they brought everybody back. And I mean, I hate to bring this back to the Sparks again, but like having watched a team that has a bunch of unrestricted free agents that all just walk, it's kind of nice when they stay, you know? It's a good thing.
I got you. And Steve, you are also high on the Storm.
Of course I am. Sue Bird's going out on top. I mean, maybe not, but I feel like it's no, I like that the Storm added defense. They have more versatility. I think there's more options for them as far as being able to score and play on both ends of the floor. I like not just adding Gabby Williams, but adding January. That's going to pay off in a way that people may not expect. So I think the Storm did what they were supposed to do to gear up for another run. Like, I see we keep not talking about the Aces, but that's okay.
Oh, you know me too well. I was about to ask Sabrina, because we have not had a conversation about this yet. What are your thoughts on the Aces offseason?
Did they add any players of consequence? I'm not asking to be facetious. I'm trying to remember if I am missing anyone.
Big off the top of my head, like they brought Ricardo Williams back.
Right. Kept Asia on that extension.
Yeah. Colson got the training camp deal. I don't know where that's going.
But Angel's gone. Liz is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, they brought in Becky Hammon, which could be more impactful than any free agency addition that any other team makes if
they shoot.
I don't know, they start taking threes. I have a hard time with the Aces because, so I've said that I thought the Storm were the best team. I think talent-wise, the Aces were the best team in the league last year, just top to bottom. And I am confused by their shortcomings in the playoffs against a Phoenix team that was running seven players and should not have been able to beat them. I'm still confused. I don't really know how it happened. I spent many, many minutes on a podcast with Evan Gualberto trying to figure out what happened, and I don't think I arrived at a satisfying conclusion. But Asia Wilson, without Liz, I assume we're going to see something close to her 2020 MVP form. Like that should be the benchmark for what we get from Asia Wilson. Her and Chelsea Gray is just a delightful combination. I mean, and then if we get a similar season from Raquana Williams, where you cannot leave her and she actually provides some meaningful defensive resistance, like there's just so much good happening on that roster. If they can just step 3 feet back and like start getting some more points in their half court offense, like I see no reason why they can't be the team that wins it all this year. But I also know that like there's some, the vibes are better in their locker room now. So that's got to count for something.
I get you. It's so weird to watch an Aces team over the last couple of years, really. But like watching them rank highly in pace, rank highly in offensive rating, and just not take threes. It's just an infuriating experience.
They do a lot of things well. And the thing is, like, they have so many good three-point shooters, too. Like, Kelsey can take threes for my money, like, every single time she walks down the court. Put it up, Plum. Like, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to miss the two-man game that she had with Liz, but you could really put any big there, and it'll work with Kelsey, just the gravity that she has as a shooter. But my one question for you, Nikias, will they start De'Erica Hamby now? Are they contractually obligated to bring her off the bench so she can win her fourth Sixth Woman of the Year award?
I don't... honestly, I don't care. Like, my vision is like, hey, get some sort of floor spacing for, because like, I've just wanted to see AJ at the five consistent. Like, that's kind of been, I wasn't super upset with Liz walking. I don't know how much of a hot take that was. That is. But like, I wasn't super upset about it, because I feel like even last year, the best iteration of the team was when Asia and De'Aaron Campbell were in the front court together. Like, they just have that high-low chemistry. They have more mobility defensively. Like, that just seems to be, that's their winning combination up front. So I don't really mind if they start together, but at the very least, they need to be closing games together. And I don't think that's going to be any sort of question, provided they stay healthy.
Yeah, that's the dirty secret, is that Hamby hasn't been healthy in each of the last two postseasons. Like, I think people forget that she was just conspicuously played like 5 minutes in the last game of their season last year. Yeah, I wish they had like one more forward, you know, just to play next to Asia. Because like, Hamby can play those minutes, but who else is there? Like, Jackie Young isn't going to move up to the four. Are you just going to play minutes at the five with like Kia Stokes? Or I saw Kalani Brown got a training camp deal too. Like, well, what's the plan when Hamby's not on the court is my question.
Yeah. I feel like Asia, Kia Stokes would probably be the answer. I don't know if I love that. I probably don't love that, to be completely honest with you. But I mean, I guess if those are placeholder minutes, you just have to hope you don't lose those too badly. And then you get to the front court that you want to get to. So I don't know. I'm not a fan of punting minutes, but I guess if you have the MVP up front, you can kind of weather that storm. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm more so excited for Becky Hammon to transform this offense a little bit. Like, I hope we get the Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr type leap this year. We'll see.
Cannot wait till it's a post up first five plays of the game.
you'll be co-hosting the Dunker Spot with a guest after opening weekend. Oh goodness. I have a couple of college women's basketball questions for you before we get you out of here. One, where do you fall on the Caitlin Clark versus Aaliyah Boston debate for player of the year?
It's Aaliyah Boston. Yeah, that's where I fall.
There we go.
Best team in the league, best player on the best team. She just does it on both ends of the floor. The fact that you can just give her the ball on every single possession and like know that something good is going to happen, and then also trust her to protect the basket and switch out. Like, she's just a complete player in a way that, like, as exciting as Caitlin Clark is to watch, I think Aaliyah Boston means more to her team.
Yeah, pretty succinct case in my opinion. Steve, where are you at on player of the year?
I think it still has to go to Boston as well. I understand the argument for Clark. Incredibly exciting player, great shooter. But I think with what Boston does on both ends of the floor, in the post, rebounding, the seals, the defense, too important for too important of a team, too consistent for too good of a team. I don't know how you don't give it to her.
Okay, it is a clean.
I mean, when Aaliyah Boston dyed her hair orange to go into Tennessee for that game, I just knew, I was like, oh, we're done. Like, this is her year.
She is one of one. We got a clean sweep on the podcast. I also think it's Aaliyah Boston. And two, just kind of zooming out as we are heading into March Madness time. I'm glad that they're finally sharing that. That bit of low-hanging fruit, but that's another pod for another day. At any rate, who is your favorite heading into the tournament?
I'm going to exhibit some West Coast bias here and say Stanford. Any national champs haven't lost since they played South Carolina earlier this year. Haley Jones is my favorite player in the country. She's, I just so love watching her work. Cameron Brink is a menace. Just her, you can definitely tell that she grew up playing volleyball, the way she blocks shots, and it's fun to watch those spikes. Mm-hmm. And then you've got just a little bit of everything. Like, the Lexi Hall's a good shooter. Anna Wilson can just be deployed on any perimeter player, and that is going to make their night miserable. You've got Fran Bellevue, who just like comes off the bench and just mucks things up. Like, there's so much talent on that team. I know that, like, unless you're Connecticut, you don't really repeat, but I like the Stanford team a lot. And that's who I'm going with.
All right. Fair enough. Steve, did you have a pick?
Stanford was going to be my sleeper. So I'll just be basic and say UConn. Joking. Joking.
No, I think Stanford has a solid shot. I don't know if South Carolina gets it done. And I only say that after watching the Kentucky game, in which everything just kind of stopped. Mm-hmm. And like I was watching it and I was like, wait a minute, something's happening here. Then the offense slowed down, everything bogged down defensively. It wasn't as crisp, as connected. And now they're rattled. And now, so I don't know if, I don't want to say, I don't know if they can take a punch. That's too strong. But in the tournament, you're going to have one of those games.
Right.
The other team is going to have one of those nights. So you're going to have to handle those 2-3 minutes where the game's in balance. So that's my concern with South Carolina. I think Stanford's just going to, it's been so good on the low for the majority of the season. It's tough. Also, shout out to the UNLV Lady Rebels for making the tournament. Sweet 16, here we go.
Oh, there you go. All right. Are you going to be in the crowd? Go to Sweet 16. I won't be in the crowd.
I'll be watching, though.
Yeah.
There we go. I want to exhibit some bias and say UConn, but like I'm just not doing that. I think South Carolina comes out this year.
They've lost 2 games by a total of 3 points all year. Like, it feels silly to pick against them, especially when we've just spent all this time talking about how Leah Boston is the player of the year. And I worry about Stanford just throwing the ball all over the gym sometimes. Like, they miss Kiana Williams. Like, they don't really have a tried and true point guard. But I don't know. They run some fun stuff. And like I said, Haley Jones, just every time you needed her to get a shot for you last year, she did in the tournament. And she's been doing that in the Pac-12 this year, too. So that's where I am.
Fair enough. Did
you see that shot that she hit, like, while like falling to her butt, like basically doing a squat while she got an and one against Oregon? It's one of the most incredible moments of this season.
Good stuff. All right, Sabrina, thank you for hopping on. Where can the people find you and your work?
Yeah, so I cover all types of women's basketball, college, pro, EuroLeague, anything at swishappeal.com. And I'm on Twitter at SabrinaJM.
There we go. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. You can find us. We are, Jesus.
Are you okay?
No.
Do I need to do the outro again?
No, you don't. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
I can't believe you cut my Stephanie Dolson segment.